This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 228, was recorded on July 16th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Lynn Alden joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss everything from the recession to equity markets to bond yields to gold to inflation and much, much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick will talk us through one of his signature chart decks. I'd also like to announce that for the next 2 weeks, we'll be having our summer break for our production staff. We do have episodes coming your way for the next 2 weeks. They're pre-recorded in a different format, so the entire episode is going to be a long-form feature interview. We won't have a market wrap or a post-game segment. Then on August 6th, we'll be back to our regular format with a post-game and market rep. Next week, we're going to be featuring our good friend, Grant Williams. Grant has given us just a terrific long-form interview. We went well over an hour with this one, and I think you're really going to love it. We get into everything from social unrest to gold to the big picture of where markets are headed, inflation and deflation. We pretty much cover it all with Grant. And then the following week, we're going to have Jeff Snyder back to talk about the dollar shortage and what some of the structural issues affecting the U.S. dollar system are behind the scenes. Then August 6th, the following week, we'll be back with our regular format.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump to the S&P 500. I mean, we've been tapping more or less around 3,200. It still have not beat those early June highs. What's your take on the markets at these levels?
You know, I think that this is really just getting silly at this point. I think the market is chasing headline news that's completely out of context on the COVID-19 crisis. If you look at the detail of the tape action, the big moves up that have happened this week, the first one was where somebody used the word vaccine in a headline. And frankly, there was no news there. It was just a routine press release that was saying a couple of clinical trials had been approved to see if a vaccine works. There was no new news about some particularly promising vaccine or anything like that. It was just the word vaccine shows up, markets start going up on what they think is news. Then we saw the second one was Moderna's vaccine efforts. Again, last time this happened, Moderna insiders were selling into the rally in the stock. I bet they're selling into this rally. I don't think there's any reason to think that there's any magical cure coming. Now, if you're actually paying attention to what's going on in COVID-19 research, you know that there is mounting evidence that leads us to very, very different conclusions. First of all, what we're finding in, again, the science is not completely in on this. We're dealing with some research which is not yet peer-reviewed, so it's early to say with any certainty. But there's mounting evidence that antibodies that protect against COVID-19, although they do form, it appears that they may only last 6 to 8 weeks before they become ineffective again. The implications of that are staggering. It might mean that we never get to a true herd immunity. And either we never get a vaccine, or I should say the likely outcome would be that there is never going to be a one-time vaccine where you get the shot and you can forget about COVID-19 and you're all set for the rest of your life. We might get to a situation where if a vaccine can be developed, it's something that everybody has to take once a month. Now, there is some medical precedent in other forms of hormone therapy and so forth where people have to take a shot once a month. They have developed implantable devices that time-release medication so that you can take your once-a-month shot and just get something implanted into your body that really releases it, and you only have to get that implant replaced once every couple of years or something. So maybe it ends up going down that path. I don't know. But the point is, if anything, the news that we're seeing coming out about COVID-19 is it looks like the antibodies that form to protect the immune system against COVID-19, first of all, the antibodies against one strain may not protect against a different mutation of the virus. That means you could still get it again on the other strain, even though you just had the first strain. Even if we developed a antibody vaccine against all of the strains, it would probably only have an effective period of 6 to 8 weeks from the science that we're seeing so far. Meanwhile, other research out this week, and again, it's very early, it's not yet peer-reviewed, it's, you know, the jury's not in yet, but it appears that there is mounting evidence that even asymptomatic cases, all the people you hear about where they say, look, for the vast majority of people, you know, they get this thing, but it's no big deal. It's nothing worse than the flu. What we're learning is that there are more evidence, and still it's very early, it's not conclusive yet, but more and more evidence that suggests even these mild cases might actually have permanent, lasting, long-term health implications. So the real news is this is looking worse than we thought before. What the market's doing is rallying every time the word vaccine shows up in a headline someplace. I don't think that the market's in touch with reality on this one. As far as what happens next, I don't know. I'm just guessing. I would say the market keeps on rallying on the next vaccine headline. Eventually, someday, we get to a recognition of reality, but the market is very much out of touch with it right now.
Eric, let's move on to the dollar index. And we're testing this 96 level. That was where the June low came in. The euro is pushing to the, towards its top end of its boundaries. And then today it just reverses off that support line. I mean, this dollar, it seems like to be the consensus trade, but it doesn't seem to have any momentum. What's your take? Can we see a dollar bottom here, or is the trend going to continue?
I think it's a little too early to say that. The number we've been watching is 96, even on the dollar index on the September contract. And we hadn't seen a daily close below that. We still haven't seen a daily close because yesterday's close was just a tiny little hair above it. We did trade below 96 for the first time in a month intraday yesterday. And no surprise, what we're seeing today is a vigorous bounce off of that important technical level. Okay, is that a dead cat bounce or is that a beginning of a price reversal? We don't know that yet. It's too early to say. If what we end up doing is just dead cat bouncing and closing below 96, I'd say, it's time to really start to worry about where this trend is going. But I think there's plenty of room to rally back up. If you look at, you know, we went down to 96 and back up almost to 98. We're back down to 96. Are we going to rally back up to 98 and just consolidate between 96 and 98? Or are we going to break below 96? That's the next thing to watch. As far as which way it goes, well, we'll have to let the tape show us.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil. And crude oil has just been hovering up along this 40 handle for over a month. What's your take on what's going on here?
Well, as our regular listeners remember, I said about a month ago, you know, look for crude oil and for this rally to top out somewhere between $41 and $42 as we fill in that gap on the, you know, from the way down during the crash when the crisis first began. And sure enough, that's where it topped out. 41.63 was the high back on the 23rd of last month. Well, since then, I was expecting a reversal to the downside. Instead, it's really kind of leveled off. And we've had quite a few little false breakdowns where it looks like, okay, we've got some bad virus news. It looks like, you know, maybe the market's ready to finally sell off. And just as it starts to get going, or it looks like it's going to get going, all of a sudden it bounces back up again. And that's what we've seen again this week. We didn't get quite back up to that 41.63. It looks like 41.25 was the high this week. But we're still, you know, holding on to that same level. I still think that the COVID-19 situation is getting worse. We're seeing now more than 65,000 cases per day in the U.S. That's almost double the previous peak that was thought to be the worst of it back in April. And the deaths are turning up too, not quite as sharply as I had feared, but the rate of deaths is turning up. So there's lots of reasons to expect more demand destruction in the U.S. and elsewhere because of COVID-19. Meanwhile, some people had speculated, well, maybe OPEC Plus will extend their production cuts and not start tapering them back next next month as originally planned. They had their meeting this week. They didn't decide to do that. They're staying to the original plan where they will begin to increase production again next week. Now, our good friend Anas Al-Haji tells us that he's really not concerned about that affecting the market nearly as much as other analysts. Let's come back to that in the post-game segment when we can talk about a chart which Anas sent us. Meanwhile, inventory this week, crude oil drawing down 7.5 million barrels, only 100,000 barrels of a build on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So it seems like that big flow that we were seeing into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is maybe tapering down or ending. So while the storage crisis is not over yet, you know, we're back to a significant drawdown this week. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 949,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 3.1 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 453,000 barrels. U.S. production stayed steady at 11 million barrels. Tape action modestly up on the inventory news, but still not getting back to the previous high for 41.63, set back on the 23rd of June. Patrick, let's come back to the JMMC meeting and OPEC Plus in the postgame segment.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, which tried to stay above 1800 for almost a week now. But today we are just getting a break that's poking down below there. It seems like gold couldn't get any traction on the upside. What's your take here?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's not a red flag yet, but it's kind of a yellow flag. We got what would normally have been the buy signal of a, you know, daily close above 1800 that was sustained for two or three sessions. A lot of people thought that that would be the signal that kind of confirmed the bull market was going to move to its next phase. Now, there's also a good argument to say 1800 was a number a lot of people were looking at because it's kind of a psychological round number. But really, the technical level should have been about 1786 or so. And we haven't closed below that yet. We're looking at about 1790. 96 right now on the August contract. So that's still, you know, $10 above what might be considered the breakout zone. If we got a daily close below 1786, I'd really start to be concerned under that circumstance that maybe this is a false breakout that could be potentially a very bearish signal. I hope it is because, frankly, even though I added on this move up, I don't mind waiting this out and buying some more at lower prices. I'm absolutely convinced that gold is moving much higher over the next few years. But frankly, we are overdue for a technical pullback of some kind. So maybe we're seeing the startings of one. A little bit early to say that, but let's see.
Eric, let's just touch on that 10-year treasury yield.
No real change to my view, Patrick. I really don't have any conviction in either direction. I'm focusing on the long-term picture, and I'll definitely ask Lynn Alden about it in today's interview.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Lynn Alden from Lynn Alden Investment Strategy. So, Eric, why did we invite Lynn onto the show this week?
You know, Lynn's been getting a lot of people's attention on Twitter. She has an engineering background. She's not the usual finance character, and she's got a lot of really good insight. She wrote a paper not too long back about inflation and deflation, which got a lot of attention. And she's somebody I've been following on Twitter for quite a while, so we wanted to get her on the show.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup-Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup-Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Well, Eric's interview with Lynn Alden is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Lynn Alden, founder of Lynn Alden Investment Services. Lynn prepared a slide deck for today's interview. Registered users, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button above Lynn's picture that says looking for the downloads. Lynn, it's great to have you on the show. I've been following you on Twitter, and you've been getting a lot of attention in the macro world lately. So I want to talk about a lot of the subjects you've been writing about between monetary policy and inflation and deflation and so forth. But before we even go there, I want to start with how we got to the current economic environment, because so many people are saying, okay, well, you know, COVID-19 caused this or caused that. You've done some work to show that really before the virus crisis even began, there were changes occurring in the economy. So why don't you talk us through the first few slides in the deck and tell us how we got here?
Thanks for having me, Eric. And I'm big fan of your show. So the thing I was covering a lot last year was that we were having rising fiscal deficits even in an expansion year. So I show this on slide 2 in the slide deck. But basically, even though we were having declining unemployment, we were still having rising GDP, and we were having pretty good stock, you know, equity valuations going on, we still had a rising deficit, which is historically very unusual. Normally, we only get rising deficits in economic recessions. So this was more structural. It was based on, you know, initially started to happen due to rising entitlement spending just because of demographics. And then also we added to it with the tax cuts that weren't really offset by any sort of spending reduction. So we started just kind of pushing up deficits, which was beneficial for stock valuations and the economy, but is not necessarily sustainable. And this was combined with the fact that we were in a strong dollar environment. And historically, in strong dollar environments, the foreign sector is not a very large buyer of treasuries. So this happened back in the 1980s. It happened again in the late 90s. And ever since around 2015, foreigners have not been a really big buyer of treasuries. So that's forced domestic institutions over the last several years to buy a lot of those treasuries, even though there was growing supply. But the problem is that, you know, pensions and insurers, they're not really growing a ton. So they're not really buying a lot of treasuries. And we started to see that primary dealer banks, which normally are the pass-through entities for treasuries, they were holding them on their balance sheet. So instead of buying them and reselling them a lot, they were drawing down their cash levels and they were buying treasuries. So I outlined this on, these two things were highlighted on slide 3 and slide 4 of the slide deck. So with this combination of, you know, rising deficits, foreigners not really buying treasuries, and banks being forced to buy the treasuries, that caused kind of a dollar shortage here. In addition to the global dollar shortage, it was also a dollar shortage here in the U.S. financial system. And this eventually culminated in the repo spike that we saw in September, where large bank cash levels were down to about 7%, which was their post, you know, financial crisis low. Treasuries at banks were at all times high as a percentage of assets. And we transitioned to a point where the Federal Reserve had to begin buying treasuries because foreigners weren't buying a ton of treasuries, and the domestic sources of demand for those treasuries, we kind of filled up domestic balance sheets. So we started on this path of deficit monetization in late 2019 before the COVID crisis even happened. And then when we had this, you know, of course, we have this massive economic shock. We have this, so many people unemployed. So we have both a reduction in tax revenue and an increase in expenditure. So COVID blew out the deficit to roughly almost to World War II levels. But we went into this crisis already with, you know, a mounting fiscal issue.
Lynn, as we move on to page 7, you're comparing the current dislocation to 2009. Holy cow, that's a big difference. What's going on here?
Yeah, so this is the largest employment shock we've had since the Great Depression, or, you know, especially in modern post-World War II history. And a lot of people are looking for a V-shaped recovery in unemployment, which it's not clear that's going to happen. In fact, my base case is that that's not going to happen. So ever since April, I've been kind of looking for a sharp recovery at first, but then a longer grind to get the rest of the jobs back. So it's normal to see, you know, if we had this unprecedented situation where restaurants are shut down, you know, all these different airlines are a mess, we have this big shock all at once. And of course, as we get some degree of reopening, we can get kind of a rapid rebound in some of those lost jobs. However, it's also just the end of a credit cycle. So this is a big economic shock to many companies. They have to trim costs. So most likely, a lot of these jobs are going to become permanent. So even though we're already seeing a, you know, kind of a stabilization in the job losses, we have to get 10 million people back to work just to get to the same level of continued unemployment claims that we had back in 2009. So this is a really large economic shock. On page 8 of the slide deck, one thing I've been highlighting is that, you know, back in March and then and for the rest of this year, people have been trying to figure out if that March bottom in the equity market was the bottom or just, you know, a bottom followed by a bear market rally and eventually a new bottom. Now, historically, the Wilshire and just the broader U.S. stock market tends to bottom around the same time that initial jobless claims peak, right? So instead of bottoming at the worst point in total job losses, it tends to bottom at the worst point in the rate of change of those job losses, when job losses are still accelerating and getting worse. As soon as the rate of job losses starts to slow down, even if the total unemployment rate is still going up, the market tends to kind of find a stabilization point and start to kind of recover from there. So in the previous three recessions, we saw this happen. And in this recession, what's interesting is that even though this whole thing was compressed, so normally this whole job cycle takes, you know, a year or more to play out, and it all happened kind of in the span of, you know, several weeks, we still saw kind of the same timing method where the Wilshire equity market bottomed at the same time as initial jobless claims peaked pretty much within a couple of weeks there. So my base case is that so far, even though we still have a long road of recovery, we might very well have seen the equity bottom, even though I don't necessarily expect good equity turns going forward because we're already starting from a very high point of valuation here and we've already priced in a lot of recovery. I think the market could kind of be volatile for a while up and down without necessarily making a new bottom, but we'll see.
Lynn, one of the things that's been on my mind, and as you know from listening to the show, is, okay, we certainly have seen a V-shaped recovery in stock prices on the S&P, even though I don't see any signs of a real V-shaped recovery in the economy. Now, a lot of people think that the Fed's monetary policy, balance sheet expansion, and also fiscal stimulus to some extent are the drivers of that. How does the Fed and their policies fit into your model of what's going on here with equity markets?
Yeah, so it certainly plays a role because given the severe level of job losses, you know, if someone had told you a year ago that we were going to have a global pandemic and we'd have the biggest unemployment shock in modern U.S. history and, you know, throughout much of the world, you would expect a larger equity sell-off than what we saw this year, right? So you wouldn't expect a much shallower sell-off than we had, you know, during the previous crisis and even during the early 2000s crisis. We had a fairly kind of moderate equity sell-off compared to the severity of the economic damage. And a lot of that is because we had unprecedented fiscal and monetary stimulus. And I think the important variable is that they happen together. So rather than just the Fed come in and do, you know, monetary asset purchases and things like that, we also had a pretty big capital injection right into the real economy. So people got $1,200 employment checks. The federal government provided $600 a week in extra unemployment benefits. The PPP loans, we had about $500 billion go out to small businesses. We had large corporate bailout packages. We had the Fed stabilize the junk market debt, the junk bond debt. So we've had a very large, you know, roughly a $3 trillion force push up against this big economic calamity we've had. So a couple of interesting points is that we've had personal income in the United States actually go up year over year in April and May. So in April, even though, you know, people started to lose some incomes, they also got $1,200 checks and they got those for people that lost their jobs. In some cases, they got more unemployment benefits in income than they were making when they were employed on the lower end of the income spectrum. And then in May, we started to see this pull back a little bit because people weren't getting those unemployment checks, but we were still seeing, I mean, they weren't getting the helicopter checks, but they were still getting those unemployment checks.
Lynn, something I know you've written quite a lot about and something I've been thinking quite a lot about is a coming shift. The focus of monetary policy for the last 10 years has been primarily about trying to suppress interest rates by buying treasury bonds. And, you know, there's a lot of controversy about this, obviously. But a lot of people expect a shift in policy objectives. Ray Dalio calls it monetary policy 3. Some people call it QE for the people. The Modern Monetary Theory group, of course, uses their own terminology. Whatever you want to call it, there's a lot of talk about maybe a shift coming in Fed policy to where they start to focus more on pumping money into the real economy, into Main Street as opposed to Wall Street. Do you think that's coming? What shape do you think it's likely to take? And what are the implications for markets?
Yeah, I do think it's coming. And I think it's already here since about March. So ever since we had this, you know, roughly $2.7 trillion fiscal injection, we've had basically the fiscal side and the monetary side working pretty closely together, because the Federal Reserve's limit is that they can't spend, whereas the fiscal limit is that they need the Federal Reserve to buy their treasuries if they issue a ton of treasuries at once and it overwhelms demand. So what we saw is that Congress and the president were able to get all this money into the real economy. And rather than extracting that by issuing treasuries to the public, they issue treasuries that the Federal Reserve purchased through primary dealers, primarily with new dollar creation. And so, yeah, Ray Dalio refers to the three levels of monetary policy, with the first being interest rate changes, the second being asset purchases, and then the third being more direct injections of capital into the economy. And that's what we saw so far this year. So, for example, I have on slide 10 here, broad money supply year-over-year change is, you know, pretty much off the chart here. We had a well over 20% year-over-year broad money supply growth, which is the highest in modern history. And like I said, personal income up, as it show on slide 9 there, is up in this recession so far. And they're already talking about another round of fiscal later this year. That's most likely going to happen before the election, unless we get some sort of political curveball. So we're already at the stage where there's so much debt in the system and so much insolvency, and this is such a large economic shock, that policymakers are finding them forced to either have a massive deflationary crunch or to have this more inflationary monetary policy 3. And of course, it's come, like you pointed out, it comes with new names now. So we have modern monetary theory and these other ways of calling it. And it's actually, in some ways, it's not so different than what happened in World War II. So for example, on slide 12 here, you know, Ray Dalio had a great chart back in 2019, and I updated a little bit to show how the monetary policy in the 1930s matched a lot of the monetary policy in the 2010s. And then the monetary and fiscal policies of the 1940s matches a lot what we're having here in the 2020s, except instead of fighting a foreign war, we're fighting, you know, the economic war against the pandemic and the debt levels, because we have such large deficits and it's all being monetized, or at least a large part of it is being monetized by the Federal Reserve. And interestingly, the last time that the U.S. had yield curve control was in the 1940s, when we had, federal debt as the percentage of GDP got over 100%. We had very large deficits. So what the Federal Reserve did was they locked yields at 2.5% or less. And they did so by being willing to buy bonds as needed to maintain those pegs. So they had the short end of the yield curve locked at around, you know, less than 0.5%. And they had the long end locked at around 2.5%. So I have this shown on slide 13, where they locked yields. I have the 10-year yield there. They locked them at 2.5%. Even though inflation at some point in the 1940s peaked into the double digits, right? So they didn't let the market kind of set its own rates. And by doing that, they made it so that even though treasuries were paid back in real terms, they were paid back in nominal terms, they lost money on a real basis because they didn't keep up with inflation. So ever since 2019, the Federal Reserve's been talking again about yield curve control. And then, of course, in response to the pandemic economic shock, they've also been continuing to discuss that in their meeting minutes, as well as in public appearances, where they've openly discussed the Japanese yield curve control, the Australian yield curve control, and they've also looked back at the 1940s U.S. yield curve control to see how their policy tools might have to change or mimic some of those in this decade.
Lynn, you mentioned inflation two or three times in that answer. I want to come back and focus specifically on that, because back in 2009, when we made the shift from monetary policy 1 to monetary policy 2, a lot of people incorrectly predicted, okay, look, you're going to expand the Fed's balance sheet, you're going to increase the money supply, it's going to lead to runaway consumer price inflation. That never happened. What we got instead was what I would argue is runaway financial asset appreciation, which I think is a different form of inflation. If we go through this transition to monetary policy 3 or QE for the people or modern monetary theory, whatever you want to call it, does that then mean that we're headed toward the massive consumer price inflation risk that a lot of people predicted incorrectly back in 2009?
I think we're looking at a potentially more inflationary environment. Now, the actual levels that it reaches, I think, will depend a lot on magnitude. But I do think monetary policy 3 is quite different than monetary policy 2. So if you look back in the 2008-2009 period, that was a very large deflationary shock because from the stock market falling very sharply and housing prices falling sharply, U.S. household net worth fell by about $11 trillion. Over a pretty short period of time. So it dropped from about $71 trillion to about $60 trillion. And that was a very big loss in net worth. So the fact that the Federal Reserve increased their balance sheet by about, you know, $3.6 trillion, I have this laid out on slide 11. But the fact that the Federal Reserve increased their balance sheet by about $3.6 trillion, even though that scared a lot of people about inflation, that was a pretty small amount over a six-year period compared to how much net worth had been lost, because that also affects spending power, you know, because people can't get home equity loans and other ways of that, of basically monetizing their net worth. So in addition, a lot of that QE just went to recapitalizing banks. So banks went into that crisis with about 3% cash levels, which was very low. And by the end of 2014, due to the Federal Reserve purchasing assets from them, banks ended that period with about 15% cash levels, which was a recent high. So, you know, even though there's a lot of, you know, quote unquote money printing, a lot of that just went into bank recapitalization, and it was offset by a very large deflationary shock in asset prices, which lasted for, you know, a little bit of time. And then we did see over the course of that decade, asset price inflation, but not really consumer price inflation. Now, what's different this time is that a lot of the money is getting into the real economy. So we did have a $7 trillion net worth decline in the first quarter of this year. But if the stock market holds anywhere near above its March lows, and, you know, we'll see what happens with housing prices and commercial real estate. But so far, there hasn't been a very big loss to net worth, even though we've had a $3 trillion Federal Reserve balance sheet increase in a matter of months, which is a much more rapid pace than last time. And unlike last time, a lot of that's going out into the real economy. So it's getting out to people in those checks, it's getting out to businesses and trying to solve not just a liquidity issue, but also a solvency issue is what they're trying to do. So, you know, looking at history, generally, even though monetary policy 2 tends to not be very inflationary, monetary policy 3, where you combine fiscal spending with debt monetization, that tends to be somewhat more inflationary.
Okay, so we've got a type of balance sheet expansion that's likely to be more inflationary than the last type. At the same time, it seems to me like the trend socially is very much toward people demanding more accommodation from government, universal basic income, the popularity publicly of social programs and so forth, and the demand for them seems to me to be increasing very quickly. So usually when you're talking about governments needing to debase their currencies in order to fund, whether it's helicopter money or QE for the people, whatever you want to call it, usually gold comes into that conversation. I've learned, though, that different experts see it in different ways. So give us your take on why gold is relevant to this discussion. Is it because it can serve as an inflation hedge? Is it for a different reason? How does it fit into this whole equation, and why should investors be paying attention to it?
Sure. Yeah. Gold does serve as an inflation hedge, but it's more specific than that because it tends to closely follow real interest rates. So whenever real interest rates are low, gold tends to do very well. Whereas when real interest rates are high, gold tends to struggle a bit. So if we look back in history, for example, even though after that peak in gold price in the early 1980s, even though inflation was still pretty high, Volcker had raised interest rates so high that the real rate was firmly positive. And that provides, you know, if you can invest in a bank or invest in treasuries and get a real return on your money, then the opportunity cost for holding gold is very high. But if you're not getting paid any interest, or the interest you're getting paid is being offset by a larger amount of inflation, like we saw during periods in the 1970s and also in around 2011, if that starts to happen, then the opportunity cost for holding gold either goes away or even turns positive, right? Because you're holding something with zero yield, and that tends to be, it's scarce and tends to go up over time with money supply and inflation. So in an environment, if we're going in the 2020s with very large deficit spending, the Federal Reserve's already said they want to hold interest rates low for several years now. They're not even thinking about raising rates, as Powell put it. This is still a very good environment for gold. So I originally went long gold towards the end of 2018. And even though it's been a pretty good trade so far, I still think this gold rally has pretty long to run, because it's still, based on my valuation metrics, not overvalued. So on slide 14 here, I have a chart that shows that gold pretty well tracks the growth of per capita money supply over time, especially when you account for changes in real interest rates. And I consider both of those metrics still favorable for gold. So we're still having, you know, especially if we get more fiscal later this year, and then depending on who wins the election, if we get, you know, whether they want to call it infrastructure spending or green energy spending, or, you know, however they want to kind of wrap that up, I think we're going to see probably more fiscal in 2021, 2022. And so I think this continues to be a very good environment for gold. And just on these slides here, slide 14 shows that chart. Slide 15 shows gold compared to the changes in real interest rates. And then slide 16 shows that gold is still pretty cheap relative to the broad U.S. money supply compared to its historical relationship.
Lynn, you mentioned real interest rates several times, and I want to really focus on that because I agree with you. I think that we're very early in the gold bull market, the secular bull market in gold that I expect to last for most of the decade. But as you know, the role that we should play as investors is not to cheer each other on, but to really question our views and look for what's wrong with that or where the holes are. And it seems to me like you've really got to have a firm view on where treasury rates are headed from here. Because if you're in the camp where you believe that zero is not a magical number, it's just another number along the way toward negative rates, and if you think we're headed toward negative treasury rates in the U.S., well, okay, that's one story. In that case, there's still an opportunity benefit for treasury holders over gold holders. They can still look for price appreciation on their bonds if you think that's going to happen, and if you think that negative rates are possible. On the other hand, once you get to the zero bound, if you don't think we can go to negative rates, it seems to me it creates an incredibly strong bullish reflexive case for gold, because once those bond investors realize that there's no more capital appreciation to be made on the bonds, all of a sudden gold becomes so much more attractive to hold than it was previously. So I could make that argument either way, but it seems like whether or not you think treasury rates can go meaningfully negative has a huge impact on the outlook for gold. So number one, do you agree with my analysis that that relationship exists? And if so, what do you think in terms of the plausibility of negative interest rates, maybe putting a little bit of a damper on the gold bull market?
Yeah, I think it's potentially an important question over the next year or two, because if we're going to see negative rates, that's probably the time period it could happen, because we still are at risk of more solvency problems and deflationary shocks, because this crisis is still in its early stages, even though many places have, of course, opened up. So if they do move into negative interest rates, and if we see kind of that ongoing deflation, that still leaves capital appreciation for treasuries. However, we've had a 40-year bull run here in treasuries, and especially early this year and late last year was very good for treasuries. So the fact that there's still potentially some left in that trade, you know, we don't know if there is or not, but the fact that there could be, it certainly could put near-term pressure on gold. But overall, I think gold wins either way. So if we see kind of lower rates without inflation falling off, then gold and treasuries could benefit together. Whereas if we see that treasuries are not going lower, but we're also getting kind of a rebound inflation, then gold would outperform treasuries. So however you want to look at the time frame, I think, you know, treasuries still have this potential window where they could do well. I think gold is going to be the winner either way, and it's probably the higher probability setup for the long term. But I do think we have to acknowledge that there are corrections along the way. So for example, since 2018, when, you know, gold had a really good run since then, we had about four corrections along the way. And of course, the March one was pretty severe. So whenever we get these kind of highly, not highly overbought, but when we get moderately overbought situations, you know, investors shouldn't be surprised to see maybe a pullback in gold and potentially, you know, kind of a couple months of perhaps treasury outperformance and things like that.
Lynn, let's move on to slide 17. Am I reading this right that gold has actually consistently outperformed the S&P since 2010?
No. So, but this chart shows on slide 17 is that over the long term, the S&P 500 fluctuates, of course, in gold. And during periods where equity valuations start very low and we have a favorable environment for them, the S&P 500 outperforms gold considerably. Whereas on the other hand, when we have a period where equities are overvalued and we get a more inflationary environment, gold tends to do very well. So what this chart shows, the blue line shows the cyclically adjusted S&P 500 earnings yield, which is just one divided by Robert Shiller's CAPE ratio. And then the orange lines show the 10-year forward annualized returns for the S&P 500 over gold. So whenever those orange lines are positive, it means the S&P 500 outperformed. And whenever those orange lines are negative, it means gold is outperforming. So what we saw recently was that gold significantly outperformed in the early 2000s. If you bought any point over those in those years, you did very well over the next 10 years. But then once we got to, 2009, 2010, 2011 or so, it was better to buy the S&P 500 over gold. So the S&P 500 outperformed gold over the next 10 years from those time periods. Specifically, the chart goes to 2009, 2010. Now, since then, the cyclically adjusted earnings yield has continued to decrease because the CAPE ratio has gone up very far. And historically, that's creating a better and better environment for gold to potentially outperform the S&P 500. And we've actually seen since 2018, that was the low point. So S&P 500 as priced in gold reached a peak in 2018 and has since been making lower highs and lower lows. So since that point, gold has once again been outperforming. And I think if you kind of look at this in the future, I do think there's a good chance that gold will have outperformed over the next 10 years for investors that purchased in, say, 2018, 2019, 2020.
Moving on to slide 18, you're showing the gold to S&P 500 ratio. What's going on here? Why this chart and what conclusion should we draw from it?
Yeah, so there's different ways to look at that S&P 500. So for example, I often like to look at the S&P 500 as priced in gold. And like I said, it reached a peak in 2018. What this chart shows is just the opposite. So it shows the gold to S&P 500 ratio. So whenever it's rising, it means gold is outperforming the S&P 500. And whenever it's declining, it means the S&P 500 is outperforming gold. So in 2001, this ratio broke above its 50-month moving average. And that was the start of a very long bull market for gold over the S&P 500. And then in 2012, we saw this ratio break down and go below its 50-month moving average. And of course, we had a very protracted bear market in gold while the S&P 500 did very well. And then This ratio reached a bottom in 2018, which also was when the GDP growth rate peaked. We started to have a growth slowdown. The S&P 500 started, lagging a bit, started having a choppy motion. We started getting a rally in gold. So since that time, gold has outperformed the S&P 500. And in 2020, it has once again broken above its 50-month moving average, which is a pretty good kind of a long-term momentum signal here for gold over the S&P 500, which would actually somewhat validate your view that gold is likely to have a pretty long run of outperformance in the 2020s.
And moving on to slide 19, you're showing equal versus market weightings of the S&P 500 ratio. What is this slide about and what's it telling us?
So if you look back, Wilshire data has data going to the 1970s, and S&P 500 has data going to the late 1980s. And what it shows is that equal weight large cap indices tend to outperform market cap weighted indices over the long term, like over multi-decade long term, equal weight has done better because it tends to have more of a value tilt, right? So instead of chasing expensive stocks, every quarter or so, it rebalances back to get equal weighting among the large caps. And so that tends to kind of rebalance into stocks that recently did poorly. But we also see a notable pattern where, generally speaking, the equal weight version does better earlier on in an economic cycle, whereas the market weight version does better in the later stages of an economic cycle, and particularly during recessions. So 2000 was a little bit different because it was an equity bubble, but generally, this is what we see play out. And this was no different so far. So we had this you know, economic hit happen. The large cap tech stocks were the least harmed by it, in many cases benefiting by it, whereas the broader index of the S&P 500, most of those companies were hurt pretty bad by it. So we saw this big spike in outperformance of market weight over equal weight. So what I've been monitoring since this sell-off is this ratio that shows equal weight divided by market weight. And what that, it's kind of like a breadth indicator. So whenever this is going up, it means equal weight is outperforming market weight. Whenever it's going down, it means that those handful of mega caps are kind of outperforming the rest of the index. And this ratio bottomed in May of 2020, and then it retested it just recently in July. So what I've been monitoring is to see if this ratio bottoms and starts to turn up, then we're in a potentially more reflationary environment, you know, broader equity participation. But if we see this ratio break down and continue going lower, and we see these mega caps outperforming, that's pretty unhealthy sign for the market, because that's showing that, you know, economy, that stocks and companies in the real economy are still struggling, while these virtual companies, you know, that kind of benefit from COVID-19 are continuing to gather concentration. So this is a period where the S&P 500 is historically very concentrated compared to its past, compared to the past several decades. And so what I'm looking for here is potential reversal to see if we start to get a period of equal weight outperformance. And of course, this can be useful for in a variety of ways. One is, you know, there's an ETF that follows the equal weight version. So if we start to get a bottom here and an investor believes that we're kind of on a path towards the next economic cycle, you know, that's one way of expressing that as a way of outperforming the S&P 500 if that ends up being correct. In addition, just monitoring this ratio kind of gives some health signals about what the market is thinking about the economy.
Moving on to slide number 20, you're showing net international investment positions of a whole bunch of different countries. What's this slide about, and what conclusions do we draw from it?
Yeah, so these last two slides kind of carry on to the really early point I made, which is whenever the dollar's strong, foreigners tend to not buy a lot of treasuries. And I know you covered a lot in your show. We've had this global dollar shortage for a while. And a big thing I've been focusing on is that there's two sides of this coin, because the foreign sector is very short dollars, but they're also very long U.S. assets, right? So foreigners currently own about $40 trillion in U.S. assets. So the net international investment position here on slide 20 is a measure of how much U.S. assets are owned by foreigners compared to how much foreign assets are owned by people in the United States. Now, this shows the international investment position for over 30 countries. And the United States has a net international investment position, which is less than 50% of a negative 50% of GDP, which is one of the worst countries by this particular metric, which means foreigners own much more of our assets. They own $40 trillion in U.S. assets, whereas we own about $29 trillion in foreign assets. And what this means is that whenever we have a big dollar spike and we kind of put pressure on that U.S., that dollar-denominated debt held outside of the country, one of the ways that the foreign sector can respond to get dollars is by selling U.S. assets. And we saw this happen in March of this year. We also saw it happen to some extent in 2016. And so this is kind of a key metric to watch, because if we get a dollar rebound, if we get kind of a strong dollar again, the equity market is at risk of another kind of sell-off, even for the treasury market as well. Whereas if we get a weaker dollar environment, that can potentially give the equity market some more legs, because there would be potentially less foreign selling pressure.
Lynn, finally, I want to move on to the U.S. presidential election. Seems to me like we're seeing more and more just in this week's news flow that expectations around the presidential election are going to play a bigger and bigger role in markets. What are your views in terms of both the presidency as well as Congress, in terms of if there was either a Republican or a Democrat win or a sweep across all of those, what would it mean for markets? What are the things investors need to think about?
Yeah, so I think that one is that it gives us a time frame. So between now and the election, there's a pretty good chance of another round of fiscal. They've already been talking openly about that. The Democrats were in favor of more fiscal. The congressional Republicans were in favor of a smaller fiscal, but still, you know, a pretty large fiscal. And then, of course, President Trump's in favor of more fiscal because it's good for his reelection chances this autumn. Now, the election itself, you know, I don't focus heavily on it because it's not something I have an edge in. But one thing I've been thinking about is that I think there's a lot of focus on who wins the election, whereas my focus is on kind of whether or not the result ends up being divided. Because if we see, for example, Trump maintain the presidency and you see Republicans maintain control of the Senate, I think that could actually result in pretty big infrastructure spending, you know, later in 2021, because they're not going to want to have continued high unemployment. They're going to have, you know, this is going to play out for several years, this unemployment issue. And I think they're probably going to have, you know, some degree of fiscal spending. On the other hand, if we have Biden win and we get a blue sweep, you know, that poses a different set of risks. We could see, in addition to a lot of spending, we could see higher corporate tax rates and potentially higher personal tax rates. But either way, I think, whichever way that goes, I think we're going to probably see very large deficits that are being monetized. So we're still going to see some flavor of MMT happen. Now, the interesting result is what happens if Biden wins, but Republicans maintain control of the Senate, because then we could see a situation more like the Obama presidency, where there's more of a conflict between the president and Congress. And we could see, for example, Biden want to do more spending or raise taxes, but then it has trouble getting past the Senate. And we see kind of this stall. And that potentially risks, for example, more of a deflationary or disinflationary environment. Like, we could have a delay to some of that fiscal spending, and that could impact equity markets. So regardless of what you think should or shouldn't happen, it kind of affects my odds, for example, of how large of an impact I expect monetary policy 3 to have in the years ahead, a little bit based on how divided Congress is.
Lynn, you've been getting a lot of attention for the free newsletter you've been publishing as part of what you offer at Lynn Alden Investment Strategy. Please tell us not only about the newsletter, but what is Lynn Alden Investment Strategy? What do you do there? Do you also offer any other services that would be of interest to our listeners beyond the newsletter?
Yeah, lynnalden.com. I provide a bunch of free articles and a free newsletter. So investors are welcome to sign up for that. We cover, you know, macro perspectives, as well as I share portfolio ideas that I'm working on. And then in my premium service, it's a research service that's, you know, tailored for high net worth individuals. It's pretty broad. So retail, high net worth, institutional investors. And that provides a report every 2 weeks that goes over macro developments that are happening, as well as individual stock ideas. So that's been pretty popular as well.
And your first name is just one N, LynnAlden research.com. Your Twitter handle is at Lynn Alden Contact. Anything else people need to know in order to follow your work?
Nope, that pretty much covers it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. We really enjoyed the interview. Look forward to getting you back again for another update in a few months. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Lynn on, and she had so many amazing charts and great topics to talk about on these macro stuff. And I want to really expand on some of those as we get into this chart deck.
Listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart book in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you haven't yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads right above Lynn's picture. Patrick, as we dive into page 2 of this week's post-game chart book, we've got the S&P 500 chart. What's going on here with these two yellow lines?
Well, really, I just wanted to kind of put some further insights on what you were talking about in the market wrap, right? We have a market that more or less has started to run out of momentum. We haven't made a higher high in the S&P 500 in the month of June. Now, obviously, people point out the NASDAQ. We'll get to that in the next chart. But I just wanted to point out the two overhead resistance levels. What's interesting is that will there be some form of a topping formation that at least brings in a correction off of these highs? Or is there one more impulse higher on the S&P that will go for a full double top retest of those February highs? And that's one of the really interesting things that we're going to be watching. But what I wanted to really touch on was page three. What I wanted to look at is the performance of all the U.S. equities. And so what I have here in yellow is the performance of the FANG index. Then in orange, we have the NASDAQ. When the FANG has been up 45% on the year, the NASDAQ has been up about 18% on the year. But then when you get into the S&P, the Dow Jones, and the Russell, they're either flat or down, in the case of Russell, more than 10% still from the starting point of the year. And what I really wanted to get across on here is that what is the composition of the rally and where the performance has been? And obviously, it's been in the FANG stocks. But what's interesting is Harris Cooperman tweeted out this breakdown of the median results of the S&P 500 broken down by which category they are in terms of the company capitalization. And what's amazing is that the smallest companies within the S&P 500 have actually had the worst performance year to date, while every tier you go higher in terms of market capitalization, the better their performance has been. And it's actually showing the fact that really, if you have owned the biggest and largest mega cap companies, you actually are doing well. And if you had a diversification into those mid to lower tier capitalization, that you've been massively lagging. And that touches on that point that Lynn made about the equal weight S&P 500 performance versus the market cap weighted, which is the equal weight has materially underperformed. And I think one of the more really interesting investment topics to watch is, when will we see this transition moment where more of the broader market will be rallying, where the breadth really widens and where the performance really starts to catch up on these smaller companies versus it being completely lumped into simply these mega cap ones?
Well, and I think that the FANG stocks, you know, getting all of this attention, although I don't think in the long term it really makes a lot of sense, but it's easy to see how it's happening. No matter how bad the COVID-19 pandemic crisis gets, people are going to sit around and bitch about it on Facebook, and they're going to do that using an Apple device. And when they're done bitching about it on Facebook, they're going to order something on Amazon, and then they're going to sit around and watch Netflix because they can't do anything else until they Google something in order to get the latest status of the virus. So The fact that FANG stocks are being bought here, I think, may be a reflection of people not knowing what else to buy. But, you know, those are all stocks that, no matter what happens with the virus crisis, still have a viable business plan looking ahead.
So, Eric, let's move on to page four, where I put up the weekly chart of Tesla. And what an amazing chart, the way Tesla has gone parabolic. And, you know, we've had, over the many years of doing Macro Voices together, had the opportunity to go through a whole array of these different securities that have gone into these parabolic phases, whether it was cryptocurrencies or any of the other things that were running really hot into January before the turn. But boy, has this really become this huge story, and the way this is just ripping to the upside. What's your take on all of this, and how far do you think this is still going to go?
Well, Patrick, my take's not that interesting, so let me share our good friend Jim Bianco's take, which he was kind enough to email to me after we discussed Tesla in last week's show. Jim enlightened me by explaining what this is really about is speculation that Tesla is about to be included in the S&P 500 stock index. Now, in order to qualify for inclusion, I think the rule is you have to have four cumulative profitable quarters, but it's not like a recession print check where it's just got to be, you know, four positive numbers in a row. It's cumulative profits. So it's a question of whether or not there's enough profit to, you know, offset the prior loss and so forth. Anyway, the Q2 earnings have to be reported, and it may qualify Tesla to be added to the S&P. And there's a lot of speculation, according to Jim, in the marketplace that if Tesla qualifies for inclusion, that it likely will be included in the S&P S&P 500. Now, the precedent case, which is probably most relevant, would be when Yahoo was added to the S&P 500. There was something like a 63% rally in Yahoo stock between when that was first announced and when it actually became effective. Now, of course, Tesla has already rallied more than 63%, you know, off of what was the previous high, 900 or so. It's already rallied considerably more than that, but it may not be over, because if there is an inclusion of Tesla in the S&P, it means the index funds have to buy it. It's not a question of discretion or anybody thinking it's a good idea, or anybody, you know, being comfortable with the fact that a business that's never had a viable business plan ought to be in the S&P 500. Once that decision is made, if it's made, all the index funds have to buy it. If there's a trade to be found here, Patrick, let's consider that precedent case with Yahoo when it was added. Big rally from the announcement that it was going to be added until the effective date, but then the stock was down about 10% in the several sessions after that effective date. So maybe on the effective date of Tesla joining the S&P 500, if that truly happens, that event of all of those funds being forced to buy it, pushing the price even higher, maybe that's your short entry opportunity there. Certainly, this is a company that has never had a viable business plan. The notion that it's worth, you know, thousands of dollars a share, it's not worth $100 a share as far as I'm concerned. But there's plenty of reason to think that the mechanics of index inclusion could push it even higher.
Well, I'm with you on that, that we may very well see a sell-on news event, but that will certainly be something to keep an eye on. Anyway, I wanted to move on to page 5, where I put up that daily chart of the dollar index showing that 96 support line you were talking about in the market wrap. But what I find fascinating, when I look at so many of these currency charts, whether you look at different pairs like the CAD or the Aussie or the Euro, and or you look at this dollar index, from a technical perspective, looks like a very distinct downtrend in the dollar index. And everything is well advertised that the path of least resistance is for it to go lower. This has, in my mind, become incredibly consensus. And I find that it's really interesting that you can see that reflected in the commitment of trader reports. And while obviously when we're talking about caught reports when it comes to currency, the cash markets often are much larger than the speculative markets, so it doesn't have the same weight as if we were looking at caught reports on commodities. But it is interesting to see that speculators are decisively positioned short the dollar. And I asked the question, if the dollar does not follow through to this blatantly obvious breakdown pattern, is there a short squeeze on the other side? And it's definitely something that I'm going to be watching for in the next couple of weeks as we get deeper into the summer.
I agree with you, Patrick. The short dollar trade has become very popular. And if it turns out to be wrong, the short squeeze will be significant and probably create a considerable upside. Let's move on to my own favorite topic of crude oil. As we see here on page 6, crude oil futures have stopped their epic rally off of those lows back in April, but they've pretty much leveled off. And this is just the August contract chart. If you look at the continuous contract chart, that leveling off is even more pronounced. So the question is, are they topping out and about to move lower? Because we really do have a lot of bad news in the system around COVID-19. Or is this just a little pause, a consolidation before a move even higher ensues? I don't really know the answer to that question. I've been surprised. I was expecting the answer to be that prices would roll back over and, you know, maybe retrace half of that rally up and we get back down to somewhere between $25 and $30 and then resume the rally from there. So far, we haven't seen that weakness that I was expecting. Let's move on to slide number 7. Our good friend Anas Al-Haji sent me this 5-point update on his interpretation of the significance of the OPEC Plus JMMC meeting and their decision to basically stick to their original plan of tapering back their production cuts starting next month. As Anas says here, he doesn't really think that this is going to be a major impact on the market the way some people are thinking it is. Some people were saying, oh, OPEC's going to produce more energy. That's going to cause the market to crash. Anas doesn't think so. I'll leave it to our listeners to read through Anas's notes for more detail.
Right. And so I just wanted to add one thing onto that chart of crude oil. And what I find really interesting is that while it clearly still looks like the pattern of higher highs and higher lows is going, which is typical characteristics of something in trend, there is substantial divergences in momentum. And there's a substantial loss of that momentum into this rise. And what's going to be particularly interesting is that if the dollar was to surprise everyone with some sort of a reactive bounce off the lows, maybe it puts in motion some sort of risk off impulse that could potentially trigger some sort of a mean reverting correction in crude. And so it'll be really interesting in the coming weeks whether that really grabs hold. But anyway, moving on to page 8, where we have that chart of gold. And this is exactly the point that you were making. And I wanted to, you know, since we're not going to be on the air for the next 2 weeks, I sort of wanted to go through the thought process of how this plays out. Because, you know, when I think of every guest that we have on Macro Voices, or and particularly what's going on in the Twitter universe, it is pretty consensus that gold is the trade to own moving forward. And I totally agree with it, but it feels like it's almost too consensus. And when something is so blatantly consensus is happening, you would have thought that that the momentum should have been picking up on a breakout. I mean, if everyone knows that owning gold is the way to go, when we broke out, we should have seen momentum actually accelerate as everyone is chasing the trade, as the buses left the station and they're chasing. The interesting part is that there's no momentum being built here. And that to me is a red flag. And while I remain much bigger picture bullish gold, my spidey senses are telling me that something is off here and that maybe we are going to first take a pause here before resuming in the bigger picture.
Well, we're definitely on the same page, Patrick, and our longtime listeners know I was saying for months and months, boy, you know, I really believe in gold long term, but we came up so much so fast. We're overdue for a technical correction, and it doesn't change my long-term bullish view, but we are overdue for a technical correction. And we got that consolidation between 1680 and 1780, 1770 in there somewhere that lasted for several months now. And we've seen this move higher, as you say. The closing above 1800, it should have brought more upside momentum, and it hasn't. Patrick, I've said this before, and I've been wrong about it, but you know, my hope here is that we're about to begin a very significant technical correction to the downside. And the reason that we're overdue for it is there's a lot of people that have come into this market, the weak hands, as they're called, who, you know, have nothing but profit to show and are not ready to suffer any losses, who will panic if the price starts to go down, and that selling begets more selling. And there's a lot of weak hands to be shaken out of this market. Maybe we've finally gotten to the point where it's just too much up too fast, and it's time for that overdue technical correction to happen. As you say, it's become too consensus. And the thing is, I'm absolutely convinced that that too consensus view is going to be right in the long term. Governments are going to continue debasing fiat currency. Gold is going to do incredibly well over the next 10 years. The question is, over the next 6 months, is there going to be a big correction to the downside? I hope so. I want to buy more.
All right. So, and finally, I just want to leave it with that page 9, where we have that 10-year treasury yield that we continuously talk about. And I'm going to just keep reiterating the same point that this continues to be my canary in the coal mine. The fact that there's a lot of people out there talking about inflation and all of these different impulses that are coming in the market, but I'm waiting for the bond market to actually start to price this in. And right now, what to me this is showing is that maybe there's still a disinflationary impulse that still can happen, even though I do believe that we are entering a period of secular inflation in the coming decade. It doesn't necessarily have to start, you know, in the summer of 2020. And if we have a breakdown, let's say down toward 50 basis points on the 10-year, to me, that's going to be a red flag that maybe we're going to enter some risk-off impulse here on the broader market. So this is something that I continue to watch and will watch over the next couple of weeks.
And of course, while Macro Voices is going to be airing pre-recorded shows for the next couple of weeks for our summer break, Big Picture Trading is going to still be at it 4 days a week with the webinar series. So listeners, be sure to sign up for your free trial of Big Picture Trading. All the details are there on page number 10. And folks, be sure to tune back in next week for an extended length feature interview with Grant Williams, which I think you're really, really going to enjoy. Another one with Jeff Snyder a week later, and then we'll be back to our regular show format on August 6th. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to the chart deck that Lynn shared with us and the chart book we just discussed in the postgame. You're also going to find a link to the Russell Napier article titled Central Banks Have Become Irrelevant, as well as a link to a variant perception video on bottoming economies and grinding equities. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. And for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.